welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, and welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of Syosset Public Library. I'm one of your hosts, Jen, and I'm here today with a very prolific and accomplished writer. Could I ask you to introduce yourself and your book, please?
Sure. My name is Daniel Krauss, and I'm a writer of, as you said, many books, and they tend to really run the gamut of everything from middle grade books to adult novels. There's a lot in there. A lot of it is horror or horror adjacent. Not all of it, but probably three-fourths of it. It's got some sort of horrific element to it. And I've done a number of collaborations. I've done, I think at this point, four, including ones with Guillermo del Toro. I did two books with him and one book with George Romero. And the book we're here to talk about today is one that's coming out in July. One of my favorite things I've done. Called The Ghost That Ate Us, subtitle, The Tragic True Story of the Burger City Poltergeist, which is a mouthful, which is kind of a, should I talk about it, or do you want to just talk about that as we go?
That's a great introduction. So let's get right into it. So one thing that I found really interesting about this book is its structure and the way that you yourself are a character in it. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you came to the decision to sort of present this as a almost a mockumentary book, sort of fake true crime. How did that come to you?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of it. I do really like the mockumentary format, and I wanted to see it applied to a book. So that was sort of on one side. It was an approach I wanted to take. And then on the other side, I was kind of coming up with this idea for a poltergeist story. And most poltergeist stories tend to revolve around families. And that's just because that's kind of what poltergeists allegedly do. But I thought it'd be interesting to put it in a different kind of family. Like workplaces tend to be a certain kind of family, especially when you're younger and you're like a teenager and you're working at a restaurant or something, you do tend to bond in a sort of dysfunctional family type of way. So I wanted to apply a poltergeist to that. And there was something so absurd to me about setting it at a fast food restaurant that really was rides that edge of being funny. And that's where I've found the best, my favorite type of horror comes from. Like stuff that is right on the border of being absurd, that you would laugh at. And somehow that makes it, when you actually turn the corner into real horror, that almost makes it scarier or feel more upsetting, because you were sort of laughing along to it for a while, and then you feel complicit a little bit in sort of what was going on the whole time. I wanted to make this really... believable as a nonfiction. So it's got photos and captions and footnotes. And I think because it's supposedly set in this little off-brand franchise called Burger City off the interstate in Iowa, and because we're inundated with weird stories all the time, it seemed to me like something that people might believe. You know, if I said that there was a Saturday Night Live sketch about this tragedy, you might believe it, you know, and there's enough footnotes in here that are real that I think most people I know who've read the book have spent a little time at the beginning Googling things that I mentioned to see if this maybe was a story that they had heard of and just sort of, you know, it sort of passed them by after a while. But that was the hope of it. Yeah.
That's awesome, because when I was downloading the eGalley from NetGalley, I was reading reviews of other advanced readers, and there were a significant number of people who were like, I've read this book and I still don't really know if it's a true story or not. And I just love that it rides that line, you know, between being something really absurd and outlandish, but also so grounded in a sense of reality that it does make you question, you know, its truth.
Yeah, because it sounds like a joke, but I treat it extremely seriously, you know, with all this detail and all this, these timestamps and all these references to academic articles. So it's kind of fun to take something that's silly and give it the academic treatment, and thereby making you, as a reader, really wonder how much of this is real.
Yeah, I love that. You know, something that's super interesting about this is that you are actually the second author that I've interviewed this week who was here to talk about a novel in which the writer himself was a character. 2 days ago, I interviewed Dwyer Murphy about his like Brooklyn noir and Honest Living. And I was really wondering, you know, what is it like to write yourself into fiction? You know, which is an act that does have like a sort of like a long horror pedigree, because like Stephen King wrote himself into his novels, you know, and like, how do you decide when to insert your real self and when to shape something into fiction?
Well, it certainly wasn't part of my intention to put myself in it. Like, that wasn't when I was planning it, that was not part of it at all. But as soon as I started writing it, like from day one, you know, it felt like, well, who was interviewing these people like to write this book, you know, including interviews? Well, someone had interviewed them. Who, I guess it's me. You know, it just made sense that if you're putting together a nonfiction book and, you know, and you're taking these photos and collecting these tapes of audio interviews, like, there has to be someone doing that. And then as I started to write the introduction, it just made sense that, you know, I grew up in a town very much like the ones in the story. So it made sense that even as a thought experiment, if this were real, I would be a good person to write about it, because I did grow up there, and it would fascinate me and does fascinate me. So it all kind of made sense to very naturally put myself in there. And, you know, and there's some critique in the book about sort of the true crime industry. And I wanted to, if I was going to, you know, critique someone, I kind of wanted to put myself as the main character, because I didn't want to level those charges sort of at a random person when we're all sort of, and guilty is not really the word, but we're all sort of involved in the perpetuation of that, including me, you know, whether it's a podcast you listen to or documentaries or series you watch. We're all part of this sort of dubious, semi-dubious, sometimes dubious, relationship with true crime. So I wanted to sort of take the hits myself in that sense. And also putting myself in the sort of driver's chair also allowed me to effectively work the very, very ending of the book, which doesn't work, I think, unless if I'm not sort of there. That said, to sort of answer your question, I don't know about these other books, because I haven't read them that you've mentioned, but there's, in true sort of nonfiction style, there's not a ton of personal detail about me in this. Like, I wrote it as if I were really writing a nonfiction, which is to say, it's not really about me. So occasionally I mention, you know, I talk about I, because I'm sitting across from the people in the room, but it's not really about me. It's not really about things that have happened to me. That comes up every once in a while, but it's a pretty blank slate. And that's not because I was afraid to put it in, but it just seemed like that's what I would naturally do if I was writing this book. Now, that changes drastically near the end, for various reasons, but I don't, for the large part of the book, I don't think I feel like a major character, but that changes a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is what gives it a lot of its believability as a true crime book, because it does like nail so many of those conventions that you see, like the, you know, teasing the more lurid bits, like in the intro, the claims to the exclusivity of the material that you have, you know, and this like sort of removed narrator, but who does every once in a while like insert their sort of perspective onto what they're observing, you know. So one of the things that I'm really curious about is, you know, how, I guess, how your other books sort of like work mm-hmm. into this, because there's a character in this book who is frequently referencing your own actual bibliography and drawing mm-hmm. comparisons to things that have happened to other characters that you've made. And like, so what was it like to sort of like write a fan of yourself in a way,
yeah.
you know, who right. is like, who is a pretty ambiguous, creepy character in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. Again, it wasn't something I really had planned out. It just sort of happened on the page. Whereas, you know, I like the idea that this character who's at the center of this tragedy, who's been essentially convicted of killing a bunch of people. When I go to interview him, he's been reading all my books. He's been excited for me to come. So I guess, first of all, I found that just to be creepy. You know, like I'm sure this, the more popular of a writer you are, this happens more often. But there certainly are moments in, I think, in artist's life where you encounter people who are almost a little too into what you're doing. Like they know almost too much, or more frequently, it's they're around a little too much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you can't push anything without a comment. But, you know, there's just like this 99% chance everything's cool. They're just a fan, it's on the level, but there's always a little, there's always this bit of doubt and a speck of concern that, you know, maybe this is someone who's taking things from the book that I didn't intend. Just like, you know, someone could listen to a Beatles album and decide to massacre a bunch of people. You know, you just don't really ever know what's going on in people's heads.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of takes it to a worst case scenario type situation. And again, my mentioning my other books in the text is again, not a real heavy thing. It comes up a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that was just because it was another fun part of the kind of meta text. You know, there's so much of the book is sort of referencing real things via mm-hmm. real footnotes and referring to real articles. And another layer of that sort of verisimilitude, I think, and was to reference the writer of the book. And he asked me questions about those other books, and I sort of answered them in the footnotes. I thought it just made it feel real again, you know, like that was always the first order of business for the book, just to make it feel real. And sometimes in true crime, particularly paranormal true crime, that doesn't even necessarily mean that a lot is happening. You know, like they'll just be like, here's a chapter on referencing some other book, something that keeps falling off a table, you know, like that's not very interesting. But, you know, a paranormal crime, true crime book can spend a chapter on just everyone watching this. That's never explained, but I like just the oddness of all those things and sort of focusing in on them, and sort of the uneventfulness sometimes can be part of what makes something feel real.
Mm, absolutely. And I think what, you know, what makes it feel so real is that there is all of this really rich detail, and you do get these like multiple perspectives on like right. these very ambiguous incidents. Like, you know, I don't want to give too much away, but like the cold spot or like the jumping standee, you know? And something that I have a question about, like when you are sort of crafting that kind of ambiguity, is it ambiguous in your head, or do you have an answer that you are obscuring with ambiguity? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, typically when I write a book, it's not ambiguous in my head. Mm-hmm. And I know everything. I know what everything means. This book was a little different, because I tried to approach it like a reporter who didn't have any inside knowledge. And so the sort of pre-writing part of this book was really massive and extensive, because I had to approach it as a reporter. So I had to lay out all the facts first before I could start writing.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to know the timeline of events, because all this stuff would be just knowledge that I would have if I started researching this project. So I had to write out all the events that would happen. I had to know all the people's work schedules at the restaurant. I need to know who was present for which events. I need to know everyone's relationship with everyone else. So I made out all these sort of complicated grids that had each person's, you know, a paragraph in each person's relationship with everyone else. Mm-hmm. So it was this sort of this kind of almost like novel length work before I even got to the novel. And then I just approached it like a reporter. So I didn't really know anything.
Mm.
But all I had was the facts to go on. And I knew the facts were interesting. And I knew the people were interesting. And the relationships were interesting and explosive, potentially. So I just had to follow, let that kind of guide me. Now, there's some exceptions to that, which, again, come into play near the end, where a few of these random things do mean something specific.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of along the way figured those out, planted those in. But again, this book is definitely more ambiguous than most, because I think these kind of hauntings, whatever they are ambiguous by nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the, you know, something that you touched on just then about the relationships between all of the characters is something else that really grounds it in reality, I think. You were so spot on before when you were talking about how like a service industry staff or like a retail staff can become this sort of like sometimes very dysfunctional family, you know. And I remember like in my late teens, early 20s, like working at Borders, and you would work a late shift and then you'd go, you know, drinking with your coworkers, and then you'd be back for the 8 a.m. shift, and you just like spent more time with these people than you did your actual family, you know, and creates some really strong friendships, but also some really like problematic dynamics when like personalities clash. So like when you were writing these relationships into existence, like who came first? Was it like the individuals, or was it like I hate using this word, but like the vibe, you know, like the sort of where the tension was coming from? Like, did you think of the individuals first and then how they related, or the relationships and then how that would be expressed in individuals?
I think it was a number of different things. Like, I mean, just sort of on a practical level, I had to figure out how many employees a restaurant like this would even have.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured that out first. Like, you know, once I figured out I needed, I don't remember how many there are, 12, let's say. Then I was like, okay, so now I have 12 people I need to figure out. And there were some central conflicts that made sense to me. A lot of the book is kind of about how these people think that Poltergeist is really fun and exciting for a while, and is going to help them get out of this dead end job by making them kind of famous.
Mm.
And so I wanted some tension around that. Like who would get credit for the Poltergeist, who would be doing all the interviews on late night talk shows once this thing became really popular. At least one semi-love triangle.
Mm.
Then I just tried to think about, since I grew up in a place like this, just the kind of the personalities I knew. And when I worked at restaurants, you know, I thought, well, there should be like sort of a grizzled old cook, because it seemed like there was always one of those. then somebody who seems mysteriously above working at a fast food restaurant, and yet it works and you can't quite figure it out. So I kind of wanted to get that kind of cross-section of people. And it's not a really broad cross-section, because that just doesn't exist in these small towns.
Mm.
But it's amid the kind of people who live there, it's a cross-section. So yeah, that's kind of it. It was kind of a combination, you know, and it really does help when you know how many people you have to have.
Mm.
Like that, it helped to set out that at the outset. And then you just kind of feel like, well, if I'm going to pick these people off, like 10 little Indians, we have to figure out what all of them value and what can they blame on other people? Because the whole idea of it is that I don't want people to ever really know if there's really a poltergeist or not. Like, I want it to, the pain and grief comes from other people who work there. It's like the poltergeist, even if it's not real, is just a catalyst for all these tensions to explode. So it was important for all of them to have these sort of latent disagreements that were not going to explode really probably until this event started happening.
Mm. Yeah, that's so interesting, you know, because like the obviously the relationships create all these kind of like personal stakes as well as like the external stakes, you know, of like what is going on in this restaurant. And something else really interesting is that like, so obviously the poltergeist occupies the like foreground of this, but in the backdrop, there are all these other horrors, you know, that are kind of informing the story. Like there is meth and addiction, and then there's the backdrop of the 2016 election and, you know, the personal struggles of all of these different workers at Burger City. And even like there's the pandemic as the backdrop for the author investigating all this. And something I found that was really interesting was that those horrors, those like traumas, if you want to call them, are not really, they're not like mobilized in that way that's like the poltergeist is a symbol for trauma, you know, like it's actually, they are like real life horrors that like drive the action and, you know, lead the characters into certain decisions and stuff like that. And so my question, I guess, is like, how do you balance like what I'm going to call like foreground horror and background horror?
Well, it's good to have, for me, to have a sense of what the background horror is, but then to let the foreground lead you in specifics. I may have that backwards, but you know, I think when you start from the idea that you're going to write something very realistic, then you automatically start looking at real life timelines. And for the math to all work out, I realized, okay, this is going to have to take place sort of at the beginning of the 2016 election. When I was writing the book, there was no pandemic, but at some point there was a pandemic. And I was like, well, if I'm the one interviewing people in 2020, that's not going to work. I'm going to have to address the pandemic and how I'm going around interviewing people. Is it via Skype? Am I wearing a mask? Like all those information, pieces of information had to be in there now, and just made it richer though. Like it was, at first it was, I'm sure me and many other authors were like, oh God, how am I going to deal with this in my work? But it just made it better, acknowledging all these real world events. And then there's another one you mentioned, the pandemic, the election.
Oh, and like meth and addiction.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that was a huge one. I mean, that's sort of like, you know, the sort of starting metaphor of the book is sort of that, you know, the Midwest is haunted, you know, by all these, by something else. Some people say there's a poltergeist here. Other people say, no, there's no poltergeist. There's just these people who have been ruined by meth and fentanyl, all these things. And the haunted houses are really just, they're burned down meth labs. And, you know, we don't need to make up ghosts. They're everywhere all around us, and they're not splashy. You know, they're not these true crime, big splashy true crime events that we focus on. It's all of these slow deaths that we ignore.
And that's super interesting to me, because I think you can even see that at work in the book in some ways. Like the poltergeist is a welcome distraction for a lot of these characters from very real things that they're facing in their lives and their immediate futures, you know. And what I like about using stuff like the pandemic that's unexpected is that like, that's like another opportunity to explore character and like deepen character, because you're like, well, how does this person react to the pandemic? Are they super good about masking? Are they ignoring it? You know, like that's really interesting ways to use the world around you in order to like shape the characters that inhabit your world.
That's a great point. Like I used to think a long time ago that a way to really sort of show the difference between your characters was to put them in a scene where they were supposed to be dancing. And you see how everyone reacts to that. But it's a great point that you could, the COVID sort of is a shorthand. Like you could say, all right, now we have to see how all these characters are going to deal with masking or whatever. And it really gives you a very quick insight into what kind of people they are.
Absolutely. Oh man. Yeah. So like the last thing that I kind of want to talk about that I found super fascinating in this book is the role that social media plays and the ways in which like social media functions in the characters' lives, but also like drives events, you know, in addition to like expressing or reflecting events. Like, you know, at first the characters are kind of using social media to communicate what's going on, but then over time, like, the social media itself becomes the goal, you know? And so, like, there's a really real sense here of how social media functions, like, in people's lives. And I'm wondering, like, how, is that also one of the horrors in a way, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I think that, like what we were talking about earlier about the distractions, like, there are real problems, like, you know, meth addiction or whatever you want to talk about. And then there are sort of the fake problems, which are the poltergeist or whatever people are talking about on Twitter. So it's like the fact that they get wrapped into the social media feedback and is definitely intentional. And the fact that there would really be no Burger City Poltergeist without social media. Like, the whole way it starts is that they film it and they keep posting about it, and then finally someone, you know, of moderate fame retweets it, and that's all it takes, and now it picks up, and now it's this thing that everyone likes to laugh about, and isn't as funny as a ghost in a restaurant. So yeah, in a real way, the social media creates the poltergeist and essentially ruins everyone's lives.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. And you know, there's a really interesting and potentially very dark point there too, I think, about the way that tragedy can be memeified, you know, and sort of, like, removed from its context. And like the idea that, like, people are laughing at these, like, funny ghost videos, but this is like, they're also watching people's lives as they are being destroyed, you know, and there's this sort of, like, really cynical aloofness that you can get from social media too, that, like, I feel like is also at play here.
Yeah, on page one of the book, like, it's, I start off talking about essentially the memification of the Burger City Poltergeist and how it's just become sort of this punchline. It's become memes. I literally talk about memes, how the people in the story have become actual memes. Yeah, and that's a way of, like, I don't know if it's necessarily done on purpose, but it does. One of the effects of such things is it really kills it. It deadens it. So if it's something that was once serious, it beats the life out of it. And so, you know, anytime we take someone's, like, tragedy and hammer it out over social media and memes over a number of years, it stops meaning what it originally meant, and it becomes quite divorced from reality. You know, you have to see things in totality. It always makes me think of, and I think I might mention this in the book, you might have to remind me, but it always makes me think of the Rodney King video.
It does come up.
Okay. Whereas, like, you know, when the people who beat Rodney King got off, it was largely attributed to how the defense cut apart the video. And so there was, look at this kick here. Was it really a kick? Look at this hit here. Was it really that bad? But when you play the video as a whole, all the life comes back to it. But if you slice it up into little bits, it just, it dies out and begins to signify nothing.
That is so interesting and so horrifying, but I think that speaks to, I think, almost the danger of, like, the memification of these, like, real life things, is that removing things from their context removes any of their sort of, like, narrative power or significance, and can really, like, and then people start to impose all their own stuff on it, you know, like, and it becomes, like, I'm thinking almost of, like, the Zapruder film too, or Zapruder, I forget to say his name, but, like, that, like, people see whatever they want in those few seconds of video, you know, and it's just really interesting where the human mind will go and, like, what agendas they'll place on things when you remove them from their original meaning. Well, I love this book. This book is absolutely fabulous. And could I ask you what you're working on next?
Sure. I'm working on a lot of stuff. I always look this way when I get asked this question, because I've got my list of projects over here. I'm working on the second and third books in the Graveyard Girls series, which is a new, it starts coming out this September, a new series for middle grade readers. I'm writing with Lise T. Harrison. And I'm right now, like, you know, before we started this interview, I'm working on this sort of a sci-fi horror. It's my first, you know, I've written maybe 20 books, but I've never written anything that was straight sci-fi. So I'm doing that right now. And that's really been really exciting for me. I'm just absolutely loving that. And then a number of things. I've got maybe my favorite thing I've ever written coming out next year, but it still hasn't been announced, so I can't talk about that. And then a number of, a whole bunch of comic and graphic novel stuff, actually.
Oh, cool.
I did a comic a couple of years ago called The Autumnal. That was really fun and did well. I've since written a bunch of more stuff, but none of it has been announced. So there's like at least four projects that are done. I've written them, but they're haven't been out. So a lot of stuff in that format.
Oh, very cool. Yeah. Well, if you ever want to come back to talk about any of those future things, especially the sci-fi horror, that's like, that's a favorite micro genre of mine.
Yeah. It's great. I mean, it's not a huge subgenre. Like if you include like Earth in that, like aliens coming to Earth, it gets much bigger. But if you're talking about just horror in space, there's not a ton, but it's great. I mean, I love that genre too. You know, sort of the alien,
yeah,
aliens type of genre. So yeah, that's been a trip. I feel like I'm enjoying it so much that it makes me think I should have been writing sci-fi all along. Like it's building the world has been just really, really cool. But yeah, sure, I'll come back.
Excellent. Thank you. All right. Well, again, like, thank you so much for coming to speak with me and our listeners. Listeners, you can find The Ghost That Ate Us at your local library or independent bookstore as of July 12th. And it is a really fun, engrossing read. I read it in like 36 hours. It was just I could not put it down. It was so much fun. This has been Jen in conversation with Daniel Krauss, and it is time to close this chapter.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.